Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in to Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik, your host, and the website is redice.tv. So today, back on the show, we have Sam Dixon. This gentleman is like a walking library. Tons of history and knowledge that this man holds. I always enjoy hearing him speak, and it's always a pleasure to have him on the show. So thank you for coming back, Sam. Pleasure to have you here.
Well, it's great to be back. As I've said of you before, you are the best interviewer I've given probably 50 interviews, mostly to left-wing liberal press in my life. And of all the interviewers I've ever had, you are the most intelligent, the most receptive. If you were not a thought criminal, you would be a major feature on establishment media somewhere.
Well, with all those liberals and lefties, that's not setting the bar very high. But I appreciate that anyway. Thank you, Sam. It's always a pleasure, as I said, to have you on the show and hearing you speak and watch many of your lectures and presentations, both at Amarin and other conferences as well. And it's always just a treat digging into all the things that you know, all the things that we don't hear about, of course, a completely different, in some cases, interpretation of history. And that's what we're actually going to focus on today as well. We're going to talk about the seminal turning point, I would say, not only in European history and Western history, but ultimately world history. Coming up now in April here, we have the 100th year anniversary of America's entry into the First World War. And this was, of course, the war to end all wars, something that didn't happen, of course. And so to understand the Second World War, we have to first understand the First World War, of course. So we're going to, you know, talk about some of the myths and talk about the roots of America's entry into the war as well. That's really the most important thing. But before we do that, do you want to set the stage a bit in terms of what actually has happened in Europe before America is dragged into this? How do we, maybe there's a way you can kind of do an overview for us of what had happened in Europe at that point.
Well, Europe in 1914 was a greater place than it's ever been since. The continent was in a state of peace. There was more freedom of movement across European lines than there's been ever since. Could get on a train in London and you could cross the English Channel by ferry and take your train car to Paris and across Germany and into Russia and get off the train in St. Petersburg very easily. And Europe was ruled by a very highly educated elite that certainly represented their own countries, but also shared much in common. The Kaiser, the Tsar, and the King of England were all cousins. Most of them spoke English as well as their native language. Europe was also becoming more peaceful. And so things were very bright for us in 1914. 90% of the surface of the globe was either ruled from European capitals or was ruled by Europeans in other areas of the world. Only China and Abyssinia were not being ruled by Europeans. This state of affairs was catastrophically lost to us in this first of the two great Peloponnesian Wars that have gone far toward destroying our race and civilization, just as the two Peloponnesian Wars in ancient Greece destroyed Athenian and ultimately Spartan civilization too, destroyed Greek civilization, or destroyed Greece.
Yeah.
One of the myths that's put out is that there was this sort of unavoidable conflict that was eventually going to lead to war. When the historians cover this, they show things like the conflict between Germany and France over who was going to run Morocco. They point to incidents where there were flare-ups between France and Germany, and they... in the Balkans, the flare-ups between the Russians and the Austro-Hungarians, but actually Europe was on a more pacifistic direction. The people seeking revenge in France were getting a smaller and smaller hearing. The Germans had come to an agreement with Britain to stop the naval rivalry that had embittered relations between Britain and Germany, and there was no reason to think that this war was unavoidable. But the war came due to a series of terrible accidents, any one of which would have, had it not turned out the way it was and did turn out, would have prevented the war. The Tsar tried to withdraw his order for general mobilization that forced Germany and Austria-Hungary to go to war, but could not do so because of the force of public opinion, even in an autocratic monarchy like the Tsar's Russia. The crown had to bow to democratic public opinion pressure, and that pressure was for war. And out of a sense of outrage and humiliation that Russia had suffered in the Russo-Japanese War and in the Austro-Hungarian annexation of Bosnia-Herzegovina in 1908. So the war did not come about as claimed by many people, including Woodrow Wilson, in trying to get America to go to war, by a committee of German militarists who were running a militaristic Germany and who wanted war. Far from it. The democratic nations were actually more for war than the monarchies were. And democratic France spent a higher percentage of its gross national product on its military, its soldiers, and they conscripted into its army, served longer terms of duty, and had a greater percentage of its population under arms than did Germany.
Wow, that is interesting. Let me ask you about the Black Hand, right? Because we had the assassination of Franz Ferdinand, the Archduke of Austria-Hungary, and supposedly, I don't know if this is going too much into the detail, but even cut openly and officially, if you look at it, this, you know, the July crisis was kind of set off after Gavrilo Princip, who was part of this, the Black Hand, a secret society, assassinated him. How important was this event to trigger everything consequently to get the European nations into the war?
I would compare it to kind of a mine in the sea. The ship happened to encounter the mine. It provided a spark that set things in motion. There was quite a time period between the assassination of the Archduke and the outbreak of the war. I think it was about over a month as things cooked up. And Austria, unfortunately, pressed its demands too harshly upon Serbia. Serbia was undoubtedly, to a great extent, blameworthy for the assassination. Serbia was in an extremely disorganized state, in which secret societies like the Black Hand and others had more power than the government and were heavily present in the government influencing things. And the Serbs were behind the assassination, but the Austrians were foolish to press their demands as far as they did. It was better to reach some kind of compromise and go on and to have avoided it.
Mm-hmm. And of course, this is how they blame. I think the Black Hand was kind of a Serbian nationalist group, right? So you get a lot of the blame, the consequent blame after the First and Second World War, that all of this was nationalism false. So that we let's talk about that more later in kind of a broader interpretation of this. And if, you know, in the official sense, they think nationalism always leads to conflict between nations, but we can hash that out later. Okay, so what happens in Europe, and it goes by a few years here. Please share any more details about that if you want to. But let's get into then how America is dragged into the conflict, because it was, I believe, a very strong movement to actually stay out of it. What tipped the scale? What happened?
Well, specifically, the Balfour Declaration tipped the scale, which we can go into later on after we examine the forces that the cultural and ideological forces that impelled America toward war, and despite the initial desire of people to stay out. Somebody once said that America does not have an ideology. America is an ideology. And this, unfortunately, I think, is pretty close to the truth. We have a narrative of American history that is expressed in ideological terms, that we fought the war for independence, or revolution, as they prefer, for freedom. For freedom from a monarch, from bad King George, who was a tyrant, and British tyranny. We represent a repudiation of Europe, that people came here to get away from bad Europeans, and Europe is bad, America's good. This was a very bad start to European civilization in the New World. We should have followed the example of Rabbi Stephen Wise, who, when asked when he was an American, said, "I've been an American for 200 years. I've been a Jew for 3,000 years. I think that's a much more sensible approach, and we should borrow a page in their book, and we should realize that we've been Swedes and Anglo-Saxons for thousands of years and Americans for only a couple hundred years, that we are an outgrowth of Europe and a part of Europe, and we are not at war with Europe." In the presidential campaign, George Romney and others 5 years ago were saying, you know, we don't want to be Europe. I'm happy to be Europe.
Yeah.
I think America is Europe, but this myth hangs on, and it led to a narrative of American history that really Obama expressed in his second inaugural, that America is the story of freedom. It's the story of an idea. And this idea broadened down. You know, first we break free of England, then we break free of aristocracy and monarchy. Then we break, we let more people vote. Then we break free and let non-whites vote. And then we let women vote. And then we let gay people get married. It's a story of ever unfolding freedom without any reference to race or anything that is solid or granite-like. It's all a matter of ephemeral ideas. And every 4th of July, Americans are marinated in anti-monarchy, anti-British, anti-English propaganda that is simply false. Great Britain was the freest country on earth in 1776, and America was free too. George III was one of the most benevolent kings in world history. The statements said about him in the Declaration of Independence are simply untrue and are deliberate falsehoods. But people don't know that, and people like Woodrow Wilson, who bought into all of this, and for all of his later education, he remained essentially an elementary school, a kid at the 4th of July rally, talking about monarchy and tyranny and freedom and democracy. And this sort of childish view of the world grasped his mind. This created the seedbed from which the intervention in World War I could come about, because Germany, despite the fact that Russia was on the side of the Entente, Germany still was considered to be and represented the American people to be the symbol of monarchical power. We wanted to get rid of all these kings. So that created a situation that could be exploited by people. It had already been exploited in 1898 with the Spanish-American War, a war which America never should have fought, had nothing to do with us. You know, and all we got out of it were the Philippines and Puerto Rico. You know, no thank you very much. You know, this did not do anything for us. But it, right, too, was framed in terms of getting rid of monarchy and this kind of thing. We got to liberate people, got to fight wars all over the world to free people.
Yeah.
And that was really kind of a early indication of what was coming. And it was an easy war. We just blew the Spanish fleet to smithereens, and you know, just it was like a 23-year-old athlete beating up a 3-year-old. And Americans were really pleased with that. I think they probably thought World War I would be about as easy. It didn't turn out that way, but it didn't turn out to be all that difficult either. And they rather liked the idea in 1917 of intervening and you know, winning the war, and as they had won the war against Spain. But that was the background, and we had this terrible president, you know, the worst people possible in Woodrow Wilson, a goofy, childish, self-righteous prig. With no understanding of European civilization and no feeling of kinship to Europe. He was a real disaster.
Is there any way to know kind of what the main narrative or the dialogue was like at the time? Because, as I said, I think there were still two factions. One that was very prominent in terms of staying out, but generally politicians, the media, as we call them today, the elite, were they pushing for the war from day one on a pretty unified front, or was there still schism in what America was to do about this conflict?
Initially, there was a considerable schism in the ruling classes. The Jews, for instance, were sympathetic and supportive of Germany. That changed later on. They supported Germany for much the same reason they support our anti-Putin policies today. Putin stopped the predations of the Jewish oligarchs in Russia and prevented their economic exploitation of the country. And this is what really drives our hatred of Russia and our constant goading of Putin and efforts to destabilize and overthrow him. They hated the Tsar. The Tsar and his government controlled a sixth of the globe, and Jewish entrepreneurs were not able to exploit that. and it was in the hands of Christian aristocrats, and this was a situation they did not want to see continued. So they were actually initially pro-central powers, and they tried to get Palestine through the central powers, but the Turks would not agree to give them Palestine. Ultimately, the British, in negotiation with the Zionists, who had a lot of influence over Woodrow Wilson, made this Balfour Declaration, in which they promised, in exchange for the American Jewish community bringing America into the war on the Allied side, the Allies would create a Jewish ethnostate in Israel. And this then led to a change in attitude in the American media and helped bring us into the war. But initially there was split. The Anglo-Americans, not so surprisingly, were in favor of an earlier entrance, but for very different reasons from the Jewish community. I once spoke with the widow of one of the most prominent people in the Morgan investment bank over a dinner party, and I asked her who she thought was the worst president in American history, and she immediately replied, Woodrow Wilson, because I think he's one of the worst too. But I asked her why, and her answer was very interesting. She said, because he got us into the war too late. And that's quite understandable from somebody who was married to somebody who was a partner in one of this big Anglo-American bank. The American elites, the Christian elites, had heavily invested in Russia. They did not want to see the Tsar overthrown, and they certainly were not happy with the fallout where it became a communist power and their investments were confiscated. The Jewish investment firms like Kuhn Loeb, on the other hand, had no investments in Russia. And so she was angry because we didn't enter until Russia was in the hands other than those which were sympathetic to Christian investors from America. And so for her, she wanted America into the war in 1914 or 15, so as to protect their investments in Russia. But you had this split among people. You had the Irish were somewhat pro-German because they had the hatred heritage toward Britain. The Slavic communities were hostile to Germany because of Poland and Czechoslovakia and things like that. It was split up, but the Allied propaganda was very effective. They put out false propaganda about Germans turning Allied soldiers into soap bars, propaganda that was going to be recycled later in World War II. After World War I, this was admitted to be completely untrue, as it has now been admitted to be untrue by World War II, even by those who promote the idea of massive German atrocities. But anyway, they put this stuff out. The Archbishop of Canterbury is head of the Church of England and its branch in America, the Episcopal Church, which had a lot of social influence. He knowingly lied about this as a clergyman and conducted a four-year-long lying campaign by people wearing crosses and wearing robes in churches. And that had a big effect. These stories of the soap bars, the Germans removed the clappers from church bells in Belgium and strapped the feet of priests to the bells and dashed their brains out against the bells and all this stuff to turn the people of Beethoven and Mozart into just sort of wild, horrible, frenzied sadists. And that had a big impact, as did the false claims about militarism and the war to save the world for democracy and this kind of thing. Later on, with the fall of the Tsar, only a month before we entered, things changed. The Allies made the promise of Palestine to the Jews, and the Jews delivered our country to the Allies.
Okay, so that was discussed a long time before. That's very interesting. Let's talk a bit more about the Balfour Declaration and how this then was. So it was really the narrative in the media, again, that was actually driving a lot of the changes in perception, I guess. Because as you said, if those proponents of a Jewish state flip-flopped, they already at this point had that amount of influence over the media to be able to tip the scales then.
Yes, media and money influence, and also probably bribery and blackmail, which has always been a major, they've always been major components of the way government America is run. And Americans fail to see that, but you can see it on a different subject. You could see it, for instance, on the race issue. You know, Strom Thurmond was supposed, senator from South Carolina, was supposed to be the leader of Southern segregation at the U.S. Senate. And after he died, we found out that he actually had an illegitimate black baby. And this was known at all times to the Justice Department, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the FBI, and people like Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, which means that Thurmond was always a fake. He always was someone who could be taken out of office by punching a button and revealing this horrific scandal of his having this illegitimate child by a black servant. And you see this kind of thing repeated over and over again. So there was undoubtedly a lot of that too, that these people had gathered up personal sordid secrets and financial secrets about people in Congress where they could blackmail them into voting for the war. But all those things played a role in it.
Now, 1917 obviously is an incredibly tumultuous time. This is, as you've detailed, obviously when the Bolshevik Revolution occurred as well. Now, I've read some sources that there was Jacob Schiff and others from Kuhn Loeb actually was some of the bankers that personally, for example, financed Trotsky's trip from New York to Russia. He actually went through Sweden at that point. We had even a banker in Stockholm, Aschberg, who he has a son today that's very prominent in the media, pushing a lot of propaganda too, interestingly. But there was a lot of interest, it seemed, along the way that wanted to change the environment in Russia as well. I don't know how much you know about that, but do you think that was also a factor in changing the perception of the war, that or it helped to broaden the conflict by changing what was going on in Russia at the time?
Well, it helped. It removed an embarrassment to Wilson and the warmongers and the Zionists. It removed the fact that the most powerful monarchical figure in Europe, the Tsar, was one of the three components of the Allies that Wilson and others were claiming were trying to spread democracy all over the world. But the average person doesn't think, the average American is easily deceived, and he's very self-righteous. Everyone likes to believe nice things about themselves, and so they were already able to sort of fudge that. The way they can fudge the fact that we are funneling arms to the so-called Free Syrian Army through Saudi Arabia, because we claim it's a struggle to create democracy in Syria. Well, the idea that Saudi Arabia is committed to democracy in Syria is just, of course, laughable. But nobody ever connects the dots on that, and no one ever has a genuine debate on something like National Public Radio, where people are invited in to discuss this contention that we're bringing democracy to Syria. They just don't allow debates; it's all one-sided. And it was the same way then. The telegraph connections, we already had cables across the Atlantic back then, and the British early in the war cut all the cables from Germany. So the Germans were unable to make their case in America, but the British were. The Allies were, and the British were. The Germans were not.
Jeez, I didn't know that. So that was sabotage? Was that a military operation?
It was a military operation to cut their cables and seal them off.
Wow. And what do you know about, before we talk more here, detailed about the Balfour Declaration, but the Lusitania, as it was brought up. Some people, of course, even go for the false flag, explanation here. But what was that? Had that a lot to do with it?
Well, they had touching pictures of the people who died on the Lusitania, much like they've used that picture of the Arab child, who was drowned off the island. It was shown on the beach in Greece to try to tug at people's heartstrings and to open the floodgates of Muslim colonization in Europe because of the child. And there are many people that are swept by emotional things like that. And, they saw these bodies, a couple hundred Americans dead from the submarine warfare. The fact that the Germans had said it was a munition ship and had published ads in the papers in New York warning that it was a munition ship, that the passengers were just cover, and that any passenger sailing on that ship would take the risk for it. That meant nothing. It was just, look at these children who are dead and this sort of thing. And the British were allowing the situation to go on. They were putting these people at risk.
Yeah, definitely.
But that point was not made to the American people. You couldn't break through the media to make that point to people. Much like today, you can't break through the media. And the average person is not able to remember facts and to critically evaluate what the government says. And I know we want to focus on World War One and America's entrance into World War One, but this is all part of one seamless claw.
Exactly. Yes.
And this kind of one-sided thing without the one-sided reporting and propaganda, without Americans ever being asked to think critically. You see this with Assad in Syria. We're told we had Senator McCain and who's that guy from South Carolina? I can't think of
Lindsey Graham, the worm.
Graham, yeah. You had them and Hillary Clinton and Obama and others saying that Assad is a war criminal because he doesn't allow food to be shipped through the lines to feed civilians in besieged cities. Before that, you had George Bush and Tony Blair saying that Saddam and Assad are the kind of men who fire on their own people. The average American listens to that, and he gets this wonderful little frisson of self-righteousness. Oh, we Americans, we'd never had, Abraham Lincoln never fired on his own people.
Yeah.
They don't think, wait a minute, Abraham Lincoln presided over the deaths of 600,000 people in battle. In a civil war. That's what happened. Americans are no better than Assad. We're no worse than Assad. But they don't think that way. And so they could be told things like, Germany violated the rights of Belgium. And the British could say, this is a war for the sovereignty of small nations. Meanwhile, the Allies had landed their armies in Greece when Greece refused to go to war against Germany. The Allies landed there. The British landed and overthrew the Greek government, set up a puppet government. That somehow that doesn't get into our history books. We still see in the treatment of World War One and the American school books that to the extent history's covered at all, that the Germans violated British neutrality. It's never put on the other page. And by the way, the Allies did the same damn thing to the same extent.
Yeah,
exactly. You'll never see that.
Yeah,
going back to Syria one more time, you see things like the indignation of people like McCain and others that some civilians were killed in the shelling of Aleppo, and how we must go to war because this from the country that leveled Hamburg, Dresden, Nagasaki. That we don't. Fight against Americans would never bomb civilians. The average American doesn't stop and think, wait a minute, this is just ridiculous, rank hypocrisy.
Absolutely. And meanwhile, there's drone strikes on people and civilians. There's actually right now, I think that there's a cooperation with Saudi Arabia and Yemen is actually in a food crisis right now. There's actually people dying of starvation because of America's co-meddling with Saudi Arabia. You never hear about this kind of stuff.
And you see the same thing. You see the use of this false narrative of American history. That America is the story of an idea, the ideology of freedom broadening down, ever more freedom, and that this is what America is all about, freedom. Not about actual people, not about Western culture or our race or our religion. It's about an idea. You see how these corrupt forces, the war munitions, the military-industrial complex, the Zionists, the others are able to use this narrative of freedom to con the average person into going into things like the war on Iraq or the war on Syria, the war on Germany. The people who are behind the scenes, pulling the strings, they don't give a damn about all this freedom stuff. And it's it's completely hypocritical. It's not applied to countries like Saudi Arabia that has a quisling, I hate to use that word, but a quisling collaborationist government that's helping Israel and the United States. It isn't applied. The baiting of Putin and all the talk about Russia and the suppression of democracy. Not one peep out of America when the elected representatives of the third largest party in Greece are arrested and taken out of parliament. At the behest of the Israeli government, Nothing about the cancellation of the elections in Belgium when the wrong party wins the election. We don't hear about that. We hear attacks on Putin. Never going to hear attacks on the government of Greece or another NATO power, Belgium. All of the cotton candy fluff about how good we are and how we're just going about the world doing good, it's just a complete con job.
Yeah,
put over by cynical, ethnic, and financial interests.
And now you hear even leftists like defending this position, right? That they're defending aggression against Russia. They almost want war with the Nazis, and they've almost turned it around now. So now it's like the Obamas and these kinds of people are like, well, that's anti-American now, right? The culture has shifted so far in America, and it's become this, you know, neocon machine that can just spread their own version of, you know, democracy to the rest of the world. It is still a very expansionist, obviously, kind of attitude. But this has now become, if you're against that, then you're anti-American, right? You're not a patriot anymore.
Well, under their narrative, that's true. They want an America that is, as they put it, a proposition nation.
Yes.
And the unfortunate thing for those of us who don't want a proposition nation is that America, to a great extent, has always been a proposition nation. They're, not entirely, but the seeds of it were early on. They were early present. And a proposition nation is, by definition, an intolerant nation. Contrary to what we're told, and again, trying to make it like, oh, a proposition nation is so tolerant. No, I can't be a citizen of a proposition nation, and neither can Henrik.
Yeah.
You know, we don't subscribe to the liberal agenda, and so under the proposition theory of America, we are un-American. Just like in the Soviet Union, if you were a monarchist, if you were a Russian Orthodox, if you were a peasant who wanted to own his own land that had been taken away from you by the Soviets, you were, as they put it, a non-Soviet person, or even earlier, a former person. You were no longer even a person. You were a former person,
right?
Because you didn't buy into the Leninist proposition state. Only a genuine racial, cultural, national state, an organic state like what you and I want, that is the only state that can be tolerant.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit more about the Balfour Declaration and what was going on behind the scenes there. And of course, the British were in a situation where they had the ability to do what they did. They had the ability to carve up nations in many regards. There's a lot of nations formed around that time and around that period. So I guess it was, you know, Lord Balfour, as it was. There was even a famous letter written by one of the Rothschilds to Lord Balfour, kind of proposing the idea, if I remember correctly. I don't have it fresh in my memory right now, but I remember it referenced many, many times that there was people behind the scenes that were pushing Balfour and others to go in this direction. For people who don't know much about the Balfour Declaration, what should they know?
Well, that's quite right. You had people like Balfour, who was conducting negotiations in Britain, being influenced by the Rothschilds and by other Jewish figures. In America, you had the first Jewish member of the Supreme Court, Brandeis, who had been appointed by Wilson and who was a close friend of Wilson, although he laughed at Wilson. One of the amusing subnotes of history is a letter from Brandeis to another Jew, in which he laughed at what he called Wilson's goyish sentimentality. Goyish sentimentality, by which he meant that Wilson actually thought these people were his friends. He was this, I'm going to be friends with Brandeis. And Brandeis was just totally regarding him like a lump of meat, that there was no genuine friendship. It was just using self-righteous nitwit to get what they wanted. But Balfour was one of the leading Zionists in America. And the it was simply a bargain. It was to use an old Latin phrase, a quid pro quo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you give us Palestine and let us ethnically cleanse the Arabs, and we give you the United States. We use our influence in the media, which the British recognized. They recognized it already in the 19-teens. Jewish power was so great in America that they could bring America into the war if the British could reach an agreement. And they reached the agreement. The story is well told in Chaim Weizmann's autobiography, The First President of Israel. It's entitled Trial and Error. And it's all there. You won't find it on Wikipedia. You won't find it in the Life magazine that's available now in all of the grocery stores on American entry to World War One. I picked one up today. There's no mention of the Balfour Declaration there. There's none in the Wikipedia treatment of America's entry into World War One. There's no mention of it in the history books for the obvious reason that it would foment anti-Semitism. It would cause Americans to resent and be hostile to a minority of people claiming American citizenship whose loyalty is not to this country and who so cynically sent hundreds of thousands of Americans to their death for their own personal, private, racial, ethno-state.
Yeah, it's amazing that they have managed to establish something now that they deny to everyone else. We can talk more about that later. But let me go back to the Entente. You mentioned that. That's also interesting, of course, a triple Entente. France, Russia, and Great Britain. And I don't know much about this, actually, but so when Russia was, the Bolsheviks were going through their revolution, what happened with the position of Russia in the Entente at that point? Did they bail out of that? Were they still allies, or what happened there?
Well, initially, when you know, the Tsar abdicated yesterday, 100 years ago yesterday,
March 16th.
And he abdicated, and power shifted to the provisional government, as it was called, which was made up from the Russian parliament. Here again, the direction in Europe was not in the direction of tyranny and monarchy, as Woodrow Wilson and the propagandists claimed it was. But even in Russia, you'd had a parliament formed in 1905, and it controlled a lot of the spending of power of the government, and you know, things were moving toward a less centralized autocratic government. But so the Duma was in existence, and the Duma took over. But a Soviet was proclaimed at the same time when the Tsar stepped down in reaction to strikes and bread riots and mutinies by the army. And so there were two governments side by side. The provisional government was more important, but you had the Soviets, and the Soviets were heavily influenced by Jews. Most of the majority of the members of the Supreme Soviet at the time of the Tsar's abdication were living in New York. And as you said, they were loaded onto a boat and were sent from New York. They were temporarily interned in Halifax by a British naval officer who knew that they were hostile to the Allies and were wanting to overthrow the provisional government, which was continuing the war. But orders mysteriously came from London. No one has ever really figured out what was going on, but they instructed them to let them go, and they were allowed to pass through the Allied blockading fleet and through Sweden to Finland and into the Soviet Union. Likewise, the Germans allowed some of them in Switzerland, principally Lenin, to go on a sealed car through Germany into Russia. So the provisional government tried to continue the war and to fulfill its treaties with with Britain and France, but the army was breaking up and there was enormous war weariness. The Bolsheviks appealed and cashed in on that, and their thing was peace, you know, stop the war, a war to the palaces, peace to the cottages, that they'd get rid of the Tsar and overthrow the aristocracy and divide the land and so on. And the armies just began melting away. And then Lenin was able to pull off the coup of the October Revolution, of the subsequent October Revolution. And then Russia became a communist state, ruled principally by non-Russians.
Yeah, exactly. And we're going to do another segment on that at another time as we approach the 100-year anniversary on that too. Incredibly important history there, how they pulled it off, and of course what happened to the Romanovs. It's just absolutely amazing, and it's amazing that it's one of those segments in history which is, I mean, not really talked about. It's all in comparison now to Germany, right? Germany the aggressor, and it's only them. They're the worst. They are the devil incarnate and everything, and most people just leave out the Bolsheviks. No mention of it. It's amazing.
Exactly. National Public Radio a few days ago ran a featured a segment which they talked about how horrible it was that the there'd been so much anti-Soviet prejudice, and talk about movies that tried to overcome this, like Dr. Strangelove in the 60s when Kennedy was elected, tried to correct the anti-Soviet prejudice. Only an hour or two, it's only separated by a couple of hours from features demonizing Putin. Now, Putin, you know, what have the Russians done to America since the overthrow of communism? Nothing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But liberals, a lot of these liberals, those saying, scratch a liberal and you'll find a communist. A lot yeah, of these people true. Are they're not members of a party, but they don't have to be. I saw that in college, and I had professors who had pictures of Rosa Luxemburg and Trotsky up on the walls of their offices. That isn't a joke.
Yeah.
And I actually questioned them and other leftist agitators and would say, well, you know, do you ever fantasize about the Soviet Revolution? And I got a lot of them say, oh, yeah, I just dream about being with Lenin and Trotsky and storming the Winter Palace and all this sort of stuff. You know, like John Reed. There are millions of these people in America.
Yeah.
Millions of them.
Yeah. Amazing. Let me just read that then. Let's go back to the Balfour Declaration a little bit here. And the letter then that I mentioned before from Balfour says, "Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you on behalf of His Majesty's government the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionists' aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of the national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. It being clearly understood," this is the fun part of it here too, "it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political statutes enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you'd bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation." So obviously not all of this was just, all of this is just talk. All of this was just a way for them to get their way. Because of course, consequently, there has been an incredible suppression of the Arabs, the Palestinian people, basically.
As there would have to be. Yeah, just as there will be incredible oppression of the Swedish people and the American people by colonization of our country by non-Swedes and non-Americans.
Yeah.
It necessarily follows that it's going to be a very unpleasant and oppressive state for the real Americans and for Swedes. By the way, one factoid about the Balfour Declaration, when you look at it, it's actually dated November, I think it is 1917. So it looks like it was issued after American entrance, but actually the deal had been struck long before. And you can read Chaim Weizmann's account of it in his book Trial and Error, and you see that it strictly was a quid pro quo. The American Jewish community acting completely ethnocentrically and cynically in its own interest.
And also, there's an interesting kind of power shift that occurred. It really happens, of course, after the Second World War, but Britain was still in a position where they were kind of they were dictating the tempo of the day, so to speak. They were America ended up in that role after the Second World War. They became kind of expansionist and keeping in an idea. But there's a switch that occurs here at some point, a change, if you will, in that guard. What kind of situation was Britain in 1917? Were they? I mean, they were still a colonial power to a certain extent, right? I mean, they were. Had all these colonies, they have huge influence, right?
Yeah, but they were on the ropes. The World War One set in process the destruction of the British Empire. You know, they exhausted their resources. That was one reason why Chamberlain wanted peace in the 1930s. They understood they could not afford another war. Another schoolboy patriot, Churchill, goofy like Wilson, had this idea that they could fight the 6-year war against the Germans and that the British Empire would last for 1,000 years, as he said in one of his rousing speeches. No, you know, you can't do that kind of thing. So World War One terribly overextended Britain. It already, well, Ireland won its independence a couple of years afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
They had to give up control over this area that was closest to them, the first annexation and the area that posed the greatest threat to them militarily and geographically had to be turned over to a government that was hostile to them. They didn't have the means or power to coerce the Irish anymore.
Interesting. That's very interesting. What should have America done? Was there is there anything that could have made things go in it the other way?
Yes, we should have been run by Anglo-Saxons and not hyphenated Americans, as our grandparents called them. The sound foreign policy for America has always been, as enunciated by a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant Southerner, George Washington, and with an addition by white Southern Protestant Southerner, President Monroe. The correct foreign policy for America is isolationism, to use the pejorative term. Non-interventionism is the other term, but I prefer just isolationism. Coupled with the idea of the Monroe Doctrine that you don't let foreign countries get bases close to the United States in the New World. Well, we scrapped the idea of isolationism really in 1898 when we got involved fighting a European power and sent our fleet to Manila and took on the Philippines and decided we were going to be monkeying around the world the way the British and French were. And then with Kennedy, we dropped the Monroe Doctrine, allowed the Soviet Union to get a base in Cuba. So clearly the best policy for America, the Anglo-Saxon policy, the policy that benefits the most white Christian Americans, is one of isolationism, of not, as Washington said, do not get involved in foreign quarrels. And that served us well down to 1898. It is abandoning that has been a catastrophe. You see it in the Spanish-American War, our annexation of these wretched places like the Philippines and Puerto Rico, with all the problems that that's represented to us. And then in World War I, the meddling in a war that we had very little understanding about for the benefit of non-American or disloyal groups in America. And then World War II, completing the Sovietization of Eastern and Central Europe. And then the Iraq War, pouring $6 trillion into this war based upon Bush's lies. That could have been used to build us a national train system equal to that the Red Chinese are building. This meddling has been a terrible catastrophe for the ordinary American, but a bonanza for the secretive financial and ethnic elites that just manipulate these sentiments in America.
Yeah, and look at the costs now too, with Iraq in just upheaval, Libya in shambles, and what it has enabled with the migrant invasion and everything else. It's amazing.
We have no idea that you just don't go into foreign countries and overthrow their governments and start sorting that. But the average American is reared with this stuff. He's indoctrinated with it. America's going to go in. We're going to figure out who the bad guy is, and we're going to go in and get rid of that bad guy. Like that Saddam Hussein or that Assad, and if you just get rid of the bad guy, everyone's going to be like America, and you suddenly you have a Denmark in Iraq.
Right,
it's this kind of stuff. But this has deep, deep tap roots in America. When the Civil War broke out in America, and the North refused to a peaceful division of the country, Ralph Waldo Emerson, one of the leading intellectual lights of New England. Made a chilling statement that this is not merely a war to make all of America New England. This is a war to make the entire world New England.
What did he mean? What did he mean by that?
That we're going to just go around the world remaking everybody. Roll up your sleeves and just wade into other countries. We're going to go to Russia and get rid of czars, and we're going to turn all the Russians into Americans. We're going to go into Iraq, and we're going to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And we don't need to worry about the fact that you have three terribly antagonistic groups in Iraq of Kurds, Shiites, and Sunnis. While we just go in with a lot of goodwill and can-do attitude, and we'll just remake the whole world into America's image.
Yeah,
and the average American, we just cannot seem to see ourselves as others see us. We cannot look in the mirror and see ourselves as we really are. They were attacking Trump about that on NPR 2 days ago. They were saying that he had made the statement that we're not so different from Putin. They were furious. These are liberals who for years have pretended to be against the military-industrial complex, although we've always known they were secretly in their pocket. But they were were pushing the idea that, no, America is so much better than Putin, or so much better than Russia. We just don't do these bad things. This in a country where, you know, when we were overthrowing the elected government of Ukraine, which we did do on Russia's doorstep to impose a government hostile to Russia, the Russians secretly tapped the call from our Assistant Secretary of State, a woman named Noonan, a Jew, to our ambassador in Kiev, in which she tells him who we are going to make president of Ukraine.
That's right.
This is the kind of call you'd expect from Moscow to Budapest in 1956.
Right.
But there's no outcry in America. And NPR wasn't concerned. The New York Times was secretly delighted because the U.S. follows its ethnic agenda. The churches had nothing. Real Americans should be deeply concerned and ashamed of this.
Yeah. Newland, she's married to Kagan, one of the neocons. You know, it's all nepotism and inbreeding in those circles too, you know.
And then we talk about, oh, Putin may have influenced the American election. Like, this is shocking. We've had all these non-government organizations, these so-called NGOs, working to subvert Russia for a long time, to try to get Putin out and get the oligarchs back in, and to enable Wall Street and New York City and Hollywood to financially exploit the Russian people the way they were doing before Putin. It's no secret. In fact, when Russia banned foreign money from going into Russia to try to overthrow the government, subvert their political process, Senator John McCain told the American Secretary of State that this should be considered an act of war. That guy actually thinks that America has some kind of right to go into other countries and overthrow their governments. And if they resist and ban our money, it's an act of war. That's how when you embrace this kind of ideological lunatic narrative of America as a proposition nation and with American exceptionalism, this is the kind of wild stuff it leads to. It leads to McCain's remarks that other nations have no right to keep our money out, or Victoria Nuland's call on who we're going to name as our little collaborationist puppet in Kiev, and then Americans get indignant because Russia may have tried to influence our elections after we've done nothing but work night and day to try to influence their political.
I know, it's amazing. And then we actually highlighted this in one of our live weekend show, but you know, while they're pointing fingers, while America's pointing finger at Russia, they have their own staff basically compromised. It was actually a report. This report hardly got any attention, but it was actually the House Intelligence, the Foreign Affairs Committee. There was members within that on the IT staff that had gone rogue. There was even speculations whether they were actually part of the Muslim Brotherhood. It was three Arabs, three Muslims, and they were, you know, in high paid cushy jobs, these people, and they were exporting information out from the Foreign Affairs Committee. And this is going on behind their backs. You know, they have huge leaks in their own departments and don't know who's in there or what they're doing. And all they can do is stand there and blame Russia. You know, it's retarded. Absolutely. I don't know if you've even heard about that.
I've not heard about it. But the idea that you can rely upon the loyalty of immigrants is just laughable. The idea that they go and they take a little oath. You know, I swear I'm going to be loyal to America. That means nothing. It means less than nothing.
Yeah.
You bring somebody here whose family have been Chinese for 3,000 years, you think that they're actually going to not be spying for China? A Chinaman who would come here and do that would be the grossest kind of sociopath imaginable, somebody who would repudiate 3,000 years of Chineseness over a little oath he takes in order to set up shop here and turn his back on his own people. Such a person would be contemptible.
Yeah.
And Chinese are not contemptible. They are loyal to their own, and you can bet that Chinese, Indians, Mexicans, Arabs, when you hire these people, you can just forget about national security.
Yeah, that's right. And they come here with to America with their own flags. They set up their own neighborhoods and areas, and they expand. And to them, it's territory. It's only European white people that have like ethnic autism. They just don't well, understand it.
Speaking of, that's a wonderful term, ethnic autism. I also like the term ethnomasochism.
Absolutely. But
here's a vignette from World War One. Since we get back on topic.
Sure. Yeah.
That shows the way this proposition nation thinking works. After the armistice, Woodrow Wilson sailed to Europe, the Versailles Treaty, and went to Paris. He took a side trip after spending some time in Paris to London. And he, as I said, he was someone who never outgrew the kindergarten, elementary school, the talk about British tyranny and the king and all this sort of stuff. Formal education apparently did nothing to broaden his understanding of European history and our own history. But anyway, he went to London. King George hosted a banquet in honor of Wilson. And at the banquet, King George stood up and proposed a toast to our gallant American brothers in the Navy and the Army, who have fought side by side with their British brothers in this war. And so people drank the toast, and everyone waited for Wilson to get up and to give a complimentary toast to return the sentiments to Britain. Wilson, the little prig, sat on his behind and wouldn't do. He's American. He doesn't return toasts from kings. He's an American. He doesn't obey manners like lesser mortals, because he knows that kings are bad. He learned it in third grade when he went to the 4th of July rally with his little flag. And so instead, Wilson made a statement that it is foolish to talk about America, our being your cousins, much less your brothers. We are no longer an Anglo-Saxon nation to begin with. And furthermore, we don't think in such terms. We ally ourselves with ideas and ideals.
Yeah. Amazing.
I mean, that says it all.
Wow. It's so sad. And of course, then the cultural influence that America has held over the world since has also, of course, consequently managed to turn the European nations, and they've also become ethnomasochists and all this kind of stuff. And let's pick up here. We're going to take a short break here in a little bit and pick up and talk more about this. We're going to talk a bit about also what the cost of this war was, right? It introduced a uniquely horrific type of warfare as well. This is fratricide of the highest degree, a holocaust, if you will, of European men and young boys that we saw in the First World War. So let's talk more about that in the second segment, Sam. But I wanted to mention your website. You had that set up, I think it was a while ago. I think you had some help with that too. sam-dixon.com. That's where people can read more about you. I think you guys list the videos and interviews that you do there. What else is on the website? What can people find there?
I think very little. Actually, my friends have done that. I really need to get into the 21st century, but it's slow. It's hard.
Gotta get on Twitter, Sam.
I thought it was Sam _ Dixon, but it's either Sam _ or Sam _ Dixon. And Dixon with a CK, the Scottish spelling of Dixon, not the English, but the X, but the Scottish DICKSON.
Yeah. Well, they keep it to update there. There's your talk from the MPI conferences up there and from videos from 2017 and stuff. So check it out, folks. It's a good repository of the public appearances that Sam is doing.
There's a recent interview between me and Jared Taylor, which I think somebody's put up there, which I enjoyed very much.
Yeah, definitely. Why won't whites defend themselves? Great interview. So definitely check that out, folks. Have you written any books, Sam?
No, I've written occasionally a piece or two. I think I've written some things that have been in the Occidental Observer. I wrote a monograph that's been widely distributed called Shattering the Icon of Abraham Lincoln, which I felt was most important, not as a attack upon the North. I'm not interested in a fight between Northern white Christians and Southern white Christians. But it was an attack on Lincoln, on the myth of Lincoln, because it's that is the most vulnerable spot in this false narrative of American history. The idea that Lincoln was some kind of kindly and good man, and that the Civil War was a noble enterprise about liberating people. That story just does not hold up. And I know, again, we're going on a break, but you know, here again, you have this talk about Assad blockading cities and not letting supplies go through to civilians, which, of course, we did to an entire continent, two world wars, and to Iraq, after the first war on Iraq, but also in our own Civil War. Abraham Lincoln not only blockaded cities like Vicksburg and others and starved them into submission, he blockaded medical supplies from all the southern states. And the Southerners, who had a large number of northern prisoners, offered to let northern officers and northern doctors come through the lines with their own private supplies of medicines and treat their own soldiers who were dying in terrific numbers in the camps. Lincoln refused because he said, no, make the Southerners share what little they have with our prisoners. So he was so ruthless, he was willing to let his own men die from inadequate medical supplies in order to continue his blockade. We put his picture on the penny and the $5 bill and then have the gall to adopt this self-righteous, hypocritical position in the UN and elsewhere about how awful Assad is because he's not letting care packages go through the lines to enable the civilian populations in areas hostile to him to have three meals a day.
Yeah, pathetic. The double standards, the hypocrisy is just, it's unfathomable. I just don't understand how people don't see it, but they don't know, you know, and that's why we have to talk about it. We have to get that other side of the information out, which you help to achieve so well, Sam. So, very good. Then I urge people to check out the website. Have you ever thought, just quick note on this, have you ever thought about writing something, a book or, you know?
Yes, I've been busy all my life. I've been in the pursuit of financial self-sufficiency, which I thought would come much earlier. I almost attained it 10 years ago until the crash and until the Southern Poverty Law Center's very well coordinated attack on my law practice in Atlanta. Through the falsehoods that they have up, things that they knew were false, know were false, go on disseminating. But anyway, I have a number of books I want to write, and I think I will start writing pretty soon. I want to write an autobiography. I think I'm going to name it Race Pilgrim, about my life. And not that I think I'm important, but I have seen things that very few Americans have seen.
Yeah.
And I want to write that. I want to write a collection of essays to serve as a restructuring of our narrative of American history. I want to write a book of financial advice to young white nationalists and racial idealists. I call myself a racial communitarian or a racial idealist, which is what I think describes me best and you best. But there are no of these books that I would like to write.
Very good. Well, I hope you have the ability to get started soon. We definitely need it. As I said in the opening, you have a tremendous amount of knowledge and just experience and knowing these things and knowing so many things which we don't hear about. So it's definitely a very, very important addition. So I hope you get the ability to get started soon. But Sam, let's take a short break here and then we'll continue with the second segment in a little bit. We're going to talk more about World War One, the casualties, the cost, and actually some more current events I want to ask Sam about later too. But stay tuned, everyone. We'll be right back with Sam Dixon.
If I sit here down by your graveside and rest for a while in the warm summer sun, I've been walking all day and I'm nearly done. I see by your gravestone you were only 19 when you joined the great fallen in 1916. I hope you died clean. Willie McBride, was it slow and obscene? Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the fife lowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? Did the band play
wife or a sweetheart behind. In some faithful heart is your memory enshrined. Though I know that you died back in 1916, in that faithful heart are you forever 19? Or are you a stranger without even a name, enclosed in forever behind a glass pane? In an old photograph torn and tattered and stained and faded to yellow in a brown leather frame, did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the fife lowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? Did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? The sun shines bright on the green fields of France. The warm summer breeze makes the red trenches are scattered long under the plough. No gas, no barbed wire, there's no gunfire now. But here in this graveyard, it is still no man's land. The countless white crosses are mute where they stand. To man's blind indifference, to his fellow man, whole generation that were butchered and damned. Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the fife lowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? Did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the shall I hear, or really know why they died? Did they believe when they answered the call? Did they really believe that this war would end wars? The sorrow, the suffering, the glory, the shame, the killing and the dying were all done in vain. It all happened again and again and again and again and again. Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the fife lowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? Did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the fife lowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? Did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers?
Okay, folks, before taking a break between our segments, I just want to let you know that we have more interviews on our website and our YouTube channel. Lana just did one with Ayla on the White Baby Challenge that she issued and all the hate that she received after it. And I just got another one up with one of the Hoteps inquiring whether or not the alt-right share some common ground with the Hoteps. Kind of interesting interview, so definitely check that out. So just know that all of our interviews, you know, the shorter ones that are videos, does not all go into the radio archive on the website. So if you're listening to this via redice.tv, or maybe you're subscribing to our Red Ice Radio RSS feed, you won't see these additional interviews in that feed. So if you want to check out that additional material, simply go to redeyes.tv and go to the TV section. Really simple. Or you can subscribe to our channel, youtube.com/redeyesradio. Don't forget to click the little alerts button as well. If you want the RSS feed for the additional videos and shows and the excerpts that we do from Weekend Warrior, click on that big RSS button on the right-hand side on the front page at redeyes.tv and subscribe to the TV RSS feed. Then you'll get all our videos and additional interviews and excerpts that way. So the same goes if you listen through our Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Spreaker, or any of the other services that we use, then you won't catch everything there as well. Some of the interviews and all of the video material that we produce is not available on these services. So do make sure that you subscribe to all the RSS feeds that we have on redeyes.tv. Same goes for Radio 314. And also subscribe at youtube.com/redeyesradio. Again, click on that little alerts icon to get notifications when we have new stuff up. So for newcomers and people who don't know all the different channels and places where we upload material and where you can get everything that we have available, I hope that's helpful to you. So a final plug here for the most important part of what we do. Get a membership with Red Eyes. Check out the second hour of all our shows. As a member, you can also tune in live when we record our TV show, Weekend Warrior. We'll be taking your calls next show, episode 31, so don't miss it. We have a chat there as well. You can log in and chat with other members during the show, so it's a lot of fun. Also, Norse News episode 2 is in the works. Pumping that out soon here, just a day or two, so don't miss that. So if you like what we do, want to support us and want to ensure that both myself, Lana, and everyone at Red Eyes don't work ourselves to death, please subscribe. Get a membership with us so that we can hire more people, get more reporters, correspondents, help, etc. This way we can produce more, right? So redeyesmembers.com is a website where you can subscribe. All the details are there for you. You get full access to everything that we've done back to our start in 2006. That's tons of material for you guys. It's over 1,200 shows, 30 Weekend Warriors, additional videos, bunch of stuff. The good thing is a three-month subscription is only 15 euros. That's currently 15 bucks, right? US dollars. That's nothing. It's like $5 a month. There are literally tiny cappuccinos in hipster joints that are more than that. So for Votans and Christ's sake, subscribe at redeyesmembers.com and catch the awesome continuation with Sam Dixon right now as we talk more about the history of America and the error of the proposition nation. We'll see you on the other side, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for your support.